Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to The World in 10 from The Times of London. This podcast keeps you on top of the most important developments across the world. I'm James Hansen. Now, previously, we've brought you all types of stories. We have now, though, as of this week, narrowed our focus to global security, conflicts, diplomatic relations, and cybersecurity. As part of our focus on global security, we're partnering with Frontline, an interview series from Times Radio, available on YouTube with expert analysis on the world's conflicts. I'm one of Frontline's presenters. It's going to be a regular feature from now on that we bring you Frontline interviews in full on Saturdays and Sundays, which means our episodes on Saturdays and Sundays will be a little longer. But from Monday to Friday, we are very much still The World in 10. Now, the interview we bring you today is with Major General Mick Ryan, who served with the Australian Army for 3 decades, and in January 2018 took command of the Australian Defence College in Canberra. He's recently returned from Ukraine and earlier this week spoke to my Frontline colleague, Kate Gerbeau.
Hello and welcome to Frontline for Times Radio with me, Kate Gerbeau. And today we're catching up with Major General Mick Ryan. Mick served with the Australian Army for more than 30 years. He's commanded units from platoon to brigade level. And in January 2018, he took command of the Australian Defence College in Canberra. He's adjunct fellow at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He writes his own Substack and has just launched a new podcast focusing on Ukraine and geopolitics. Mick, good to have you back on Frontline. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks. It's great to be with you again.
You're recently back from Ukraine, your fourth visit in 18 months. What can you tell us about your visit?
Well, I think I have to kind of say up front that I was there just before the US supplemental was passed. So my insights, I guess, are guided by that. The Ukrainians are fatigued and frustrated at that point in time, particularly with the US Congress. But I think, too, that the last 6 months you've seen the counteroffensive fail. You saw the Zelensky civil-military crisis. You saw the debate over the mobilization bill, which has just been passed, but with thousands of amendments. I think after 27 months, fair enough, the Ukrainians are pretty fatigued and it's hard to see a light at the tunnel at the moment that isn't a Russian armored division. That is kind of the sense I got. It's not defeated. It's just, a grim realization that this is going to take some time.
And as you say, it was before that momentous $61 billion US dollar aid deal was passed and was agreed and signed off by President Biden. Can you just tell me a little bit more about what the purpose of your visit was? Who did you meet and what were you doing exactly?
Well, each of my visits have had two purposes. One, to talk to a variety of military and government officials, as well as think tanks and journalists, to get a sense of where the war is and its potential trajectories. But the second purpose is about learning about Ukraine. I mean, it's a real revelation for me from the bottom of the world. Ukraine isn't a country a lot of Australians know a lot about. So it has a dual purpose every time. This time, got to speak to pretty senior military and government officials at the ministerial level, National Security Advisor to President Zelensky, to get a fairly holistic view of where the war is at, and where it might be trending at the moment.
And what did they tell you?
Well, they told us lots of different things, some things in confidence, something happy to share. But you know, one of the important insights is, you know, what is Ukraine's theory of victory? One of our senior interlocutors said, you know, what does winning this look like for Ukraine? And I think that is an excellent question. It's probably a question only the Ukrainians can answer, but it's one that the West should help them with, both in formulating what that looks like and then helping them with the real resources to win it. We had some very interesting conversations with a Minister for Strategic Industries, very dynamic, a very competent minister who's really managed to turn around indigenous defence production in Ukraine, tripled it in 2022, doubled it again last year. It's at the point now where they have more capacity than they can fund weapons for. So that's a pretty good place to be in. Most Western countries are nowhere near that in their defence production. And we had the opportunity to talk with a bunch of students at Kyiv University to go to a very different kind of audience. You know, most of them were in uniform. You go to a Western university, that would never be the case. But in Ukraine, you have young students who are both training to be in the military and training their minds as university students. It kind of reminds you that this is a societal fight. It's not like the wars that I participated in, Iraq and Afghanistan, where a very small proportion of the country went back and did multiple tours and everyone else went on with their lives. Ukraine is a country that has been fundamentally changed because everyone, in some degree, is part of the war effort or has a relative who is.
When you say, Mick, that one of the interesting conversations you had was about what victory, what winning the war looked like with those senior figures, did you get a feeling of that there was a consensus of what that is?
Well, I think, you know, there's a consensus on the key elements. The most important bit is defeating Russia in Ukraine. The narrative from Western politicians that, you know, we need to defend Ukraine or we're in it for as long as it takes, pretty meaningless. What we really need is a statement of intent, which is about beating Russia on the battlefield in Ukraine. It's not about defeating Russia as a nation or regime change or any of those things. It's about defeating Russia in Ukraine and Ukraine getting back to its 91 borders. Now, there's a whole lot of other things that would be involved in that, whether it's the return of refugees, deoccupation, security guarantees, whether it's as a member or relationship with NATO, and membership of the EU. I mean, all these would have to be part of a theory of victory that encompass both winning the war, but also winning the peace that follows.
And the director of the CIA, Bill Burns, has said that the very real risk of the Ukrainians losing on the battlefield now, by the end of the year, or Putin being able to dictate the terms of the political settlement of a political settlement has been averted by this aid deal. How do you see the battlefield situation at the moment?
Well, it's certainly very grim. I don't think it's disastrous. So the Ukrainians are still demonstrating the ability to exchange and brigades on the battlefield and rotate them, which is a very positive sign. That's not something they've been doing previously. So I think what they're doing in the East is they're defending, and they've had to reconcile two really difficult points. One is keeping their army, which is severely undermanned until they can have mobilization kick in. And the other point is keeping their territory. Now, there's military and political imperatives for both. But I think under General Sierski and President Zelensky has accepted that sometimes to preserve the lives of their soldiers, to preserve their army, to fight another day, you have to give up a bit of territory. And I think that's really what we're seeing happen in the East now. We're not seeing the Battle of Bakhmut where there was this almost a bloody-mindedness about we must keep it. I think now there's a more pragmatic realization that we have to keep our army, and sometimes that means giving up a bit of territory. We can take it back because they have beef.
And in making those decisions on whether to pay a high price to hold ground or to move back, has the knowledge that more military aid is going to be coming made those decisions clearer? And how do you weigh up those decisions?
Well, I think the knowledge of that military aid's had a couple of really important impacts. The first one clearly got a morale impact for the government. for the military and for citizens, it means they're not being abandoned by the United States, or at least not yet. So it's had a very significant morale impact. But, you know, the flow of weapon munitions is desperately needed. We've seen very significant rationing, particularly with artillery munitions, but also with air defence, which has meant the Russians have been able to get their combat aircraft up and launch these long-range, very destructive glide bombs. So knowing that there are munitions on the way to have an impact on that, to reduce that, to degrade Russia's capacity, is very important.
And a key piece of information that's come out since this aid bill was passed is that the long-range US attackums had secretly been supplied to Ukraine and had been used on two occasions against a Russian airfield in Crimea on the 17th of April. And Russia's claiming to have shot down more destined to Crimea since. What kind of threat do they pose on the battlefield? And do you think this is a pattern that's going to be repeated, targeting Crimea?
Well, these attackums have a much longer range than the previous version that they were given last October. This version has a range out to about 300 kilometres. We're not quite sure which variants they were given, but it's probably a mix of the unitary warhead, which is one big warhead, and the cluster munition, which is lots and lots of sub-munitions. What this will permit the Ukrainians to do is target Russian operational targets. And when I say operational targets, these are targets that aren't engaged in direct combat now and aren't, you know, back in Russia. They're somewhere in between its headquarters, its logistics nodes, its reserve troop locations. And the aim is to ensure if the Ukrainians do have to engage in ground combat, they're doing it in a much leveler playing field than what they're doing now, that they're able to kill as many Russians and destroy as much of their artillery before they're actually able to engage in ground combat, which is very similar to the airline battle concept that NATO used in the Cold War.
So are we talking about potential targets deep inside Crimea, perhaps the Kerch Bridge as well?
Well, certainly most of Crimea can be held at risk. I think airfields, I think logistics nodes, Kerch Bridge might be part at headquarters, but also in southern and eastern Ukraine. So it allows the Ukrainians to target every square centimetre of their territory, which is being occupied by the Russians, which was not the case before now. It's also worth noting that the ATACMS has some fairly clever trickery involved, which allows it to degrade the ability of Russian air defences to intercept them. So that's another reason why these things are very important in the Ukrainian armoury at the moment.
Right now, the Russians will know there's a small window before Ukraine reaps the benefits of this military aid arriving. What options will it be weighing up?
Well, it'll be weighing up, you know, how much can it throw at the Ukrainians right now? I mean, it hasn't gone through another mobilisation process. We're expecting that they will, but they're still able to recruit 25 to 30,000, you know, generally replaces their losses and a little bit more. So they will be getting as many forces combat as they can right now while the Ukrainians are at their weakest. We should recall, we thought the Ukrainians weren't going to hold out very long in 2022 and they achieved amazing things. So, you know, we shouldn't be writing them off. But the Russians are doing things like moving first line parachute divisions, VDV units, from the south to the east at the moment, which is an indication that the east will be their main effort. And it's where the Russians think they have the greatest chance of making some kind of significant breakthrough.
You mentioned earlier about being in Ukraine. It was interesting from your perspective as an Australian, the bottom of the world, as you put it. What kind of perspective can you throw on this, given that you're outside Europe and outside the US?
Well, it's a fight not just for Ukraine, even though that is the most pressing need for us to support the Ukrainians. It is about defending Ukraine, but more broadly, it's about the stability of the European security architecture more broadly. You know, that includes whether it's old Europe, as a former American defense secretary called it, or the Baltics, places like Poland, Scandinavia. It will have a significant impact on them as well. places like Australia, I think, need to better understand that what Russia's doing here isn't just about Ukraine, and it's actually not just about Europe. This is about four authoritarians who've decided the time has come to challenge what they see as the West, which is all of us. So what happens in Ukraine, what happens in Europe matters in Asia and vice versa. I think countries like Poland, like Japan, have been very open about accepting that. I think Australia, as we've seen from its most recent national defence strategy, is very keen to focus just on its own backyard. I think that will backfire. I think it's strategically immature and in some cases probably immoral as well.
And one of the things that you write about in one of your recent Substacks is about the importance of strategic communications during this war and how well Ukraine did that in the first year of the war. And when you describe the way that Australia needs to understand how important it is on a global aspect, what kind of message do you think Ukraine needs to be putting out there right now?
Well, there's a few important messages. Firstly, you know, if we're not able to defend Ukraine, we're going to see more of what's already happening in occupied Ukraine. There's enormous evidence of how the Russians are torturing, raping, murdering, kidnapping people from the occupied territories. 40 million people will be subject to that if we don't help Ukraine win this war. So that's first and foremost, there's a moral imperative. Secondly, there's an imperative to defend democracy wherever it is. It's a very precious thing. It's not something that's been a possession of humans for thousands of years. It's something that we've developed at great expense over the last few centuries. And I think it's something that's worth defending. I'm not sure, though, whether democracies are willing to bear that cost. And we need to explain to our peoples, whether it's Australians or otherwise, that, you know, yes, it's tough to do that. Yes, it's expensive, but it's the lesser of two evils. But I don't see governments really engaging in these tough discussions because at the end of the day, it requires trade-offs between domestic social imperatives and international security imperatives. And for most governments, even in Europe still, domestic social imperatives seem to trump the international security ones.
And not only that, though, Mick, you also described this constant drumbeat of the escalation of terror by the West in this war, their fear that sending some of the weapons that Ukraine needs at the time it crucially needs those weapons is in some way going to escalate in a way that we are fearful of. Has that attitude changed?
I'm not sure that it has. I think our risk tolerance might have increased a bit, I think. The recent comments by French President Macron have been very interesting, and I really like that version of President Macron we're seeing at the moment, because he's probably the first Western leader that's kind of forced Putin to think, oh, wow, someone's talking about NATO boots on the ground. They haven't done that before. But all the way through this war, we've seen this escalation terror. It's like, well, we can't give them artillery, then we give them artillery. Oh, we can't give them tanks, then we give them tanks. I mean, we're going to do it. Let's just do it. And do it in a way that's speedy and allows this stuff to have an impact rather than kind of being a lagging capability. I think a really important indicator of how fearful some governments are of escalation at the moment is the most recent US statements that China has crossed a red line on the amount of dual-use technologies it's providing to Russia in this war and that it has to stop it. So I think, you know, we'll see out of the Biden administration, is it willing to put its money where its mouth is with China crossing those red lines, or is it going to take the Obama administration approach, lays out red lines, and when the adversary crosses them, it just looks the other way?
What kind of action would you like the Biden administration to take if China does continue to cross those red lines in supporting Russia?
Well, I think there's more it can do on the technology front. You got to wonder how many other American companies might be dissuaded from dealing with, although a lot of them at the moment are leaving of their own volition because of some of the laws that China brought in the last few years. So, you know, the Americans are probably going to have to be pretty creative in this because, as we've seen, sanctions against Russia have hurt them a bit, but they haven't had the full impact that we'd hope they would. I think, too, that, you know, the US will be looking at those who export other high technologies to China and might be twisting some arms there. But at the end of the day, it'll be up to the Biden administration to decide whether it wants to act Chinese across these red lines.
And then, of course, whatever comes afterwards, after November. Finally, something that's very pertinent to you, the potential expansion of the AUKUS military partnership of Australia, the UK and US to include South Korea as a pillar two partner. As I understand it, that would not mean it's not involved in the provision of conventionally armed nuclear powered submarines, but more the development of things like hypersonic missiles, underwater drones, cyber technology. This, of course, is deplored by President Xi. What effect do you think this potential expansion will have in the region, and why is it expanding?
I think it'd be a great move. And of course, the Chinese would hate it because they want to deal with each country individually. They don't want to deal with alliances because they know together we're much stronger than them. We saw recent speculation that Japan might join the elements of AUKUS. I think that would be a fabulous move. They have an enormously sophisticated broad and deep research and development capacity that outstrips Australia, certainly, potentially Britain as well. They would bring an enormous amount to AUKUS Pillar 2. And let's not forget, they've been a very responsible international citizen for many, many decades since the end of the Second World War. I think Korea are in the same boat. They're a responsible international citizen. Both Australia and the US in particular have very close and significant trading relationships with Korea. I think for Australia, it's our second or third largest trading partner. And once again, they have a very sophisticated R&D capacity, and they design and build their own submarines, warships, aircraft, armoured vehicles. So I think they bring a lot to it. It gets down to the security around that sharing of technology. But politically, I think it makes all the sense in the world.
I said, and finally, but I just have one last question. To what extent do you think what is happening in Ukraine right now and how the next 12, 24 months roll out will impact the security and what happens and the attitudes to your part of the world?
I think it has a few impacts. First and foremost, you're seeing Ukraine as a huge battle lab for new technologies that are going to spin off all over. One example is we saw Iran use exactly the same kind of tactics against Israel a couple of weeks ago that Russia's been using with its drone and missile attacks against Ukraine. That's just one example. I think you'll see other examples when it comes to information warfare, the use of drones and things like that. Now, Ukraine and the Indo-Pacific, very different terrain, weather, geography and politics. But I think there are enough lessons there about leadership, about strategic decision-making, about industrial bases that they will translate into the Indo-Pacific very well.
Mick Ryan, great to speak to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
That was Major General Mick Ryan on Frontline, the interview series from Times Radio. That's it for today. Thank you for taking the time to stay on top of the world with the help of the Times of London. We'll see you tomorrow.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.